This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A new study says that young, childless women now make more on average than their male counterparts. It's based on data gathered by the Census Bureau and analyzed by a private research firm. As NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports, it's part of a long trend that mirrors a trend in education.
If you now look at most areas of the country, unmarried women without kids from age 22 to 30 are making 8% more than men in the same demographic. And there is one major reason for that.
At this point in time, young women are 1.5 times more likely to earn college degrees than their male counterparts. That's a huge difference. And it's starting to reflect in average income.
That is James Chung, president of Reach Advisors, which did the study. Chung says it is still the case that overall women make 80% of what men make. And the survey is not saying that a woman in the same job makes more than a man. It's still not certain whether these findings signal a significant change. The big question is whether, as this group of women ages, marries, or has children, their wage advantage will disappear. Chung says he hasn't seen any evidence that it will go away. He points out that male-dominated industries like manufacturing were hit harder this recession. There are more women in managerial jobs now than men. And Chung says it's likely that when the economy rebounds, this new generation of women will be better poised to make more money.
We're seeing a preview of the post-recession economy. Who's going to be out there earning the higher incomes, and who's going to be out there reshaping the markets?
So, you're a man. How does this make you feel?
I live in one of those households.
For the up-and-coming generation, it is simply the new norm, he says. Jacqueline King is a policy analyst for the American Council on Education. She agrees education is the most important factor in explaining why younger women are making more than younger men. But she's not ready to say that these results mark a watershed event for women's wages overall.
If you were to compare women and men with similar levels of education, you would find that the men do still continue to earn more, in part because they are more likely to choose higher paying fields.
For nearly two decades, women have outnumbered men going to college. This is particularly pronounced among minority groups and at historically black colleges where women outnumber men 2-to-1. Some colleges are now trying to attract more male students by starting men's groups, showcasing their sports, and offering subjects that tend to draw in men. But King says the fact remains that even though women are going to college in greater numbers, they are more likely to take jobs in lower-paying fields like education, while men are more likely to end up in relatively high-paying positions in business and technology.
Also, women are much more likely to take time away from their careers for childcare and other family responsibilities, and that has an impact on their earnings over the course of their careers.
Chung of Reach Advisors says he plans to track these young women over the next few years to see whether, in fact, they do manage to close the gender gap. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair left office 3 years ago, but his decision to support the war in Iraq is still very much with him. In a new memoir called A Journey, Blair says he continues to study the war and even gather evidence about it. Just this year, he testified before a British panel investigating the war. He was asked if he regrets his decision to fight. Blair writes that he could not answer yes or no. His opponents would attack him either way. He had to sidestep the issue, which led to another question when he visited our studios. What is the word that would describe your feelings about this war?
I don't know that there is a word as such. I think that probably I would characterize it by saying you can't be sure yet how people will look back on this. Hopefully, Iraq will stabilize. But truthfully, what was problematic is what's problematic in Afghanistan today. It's what's problematic in many parts of the world, which is this extremist ideology that is prepared to use terror in order to disrupt and destabilize. And that is an immensely difficult thing to deal with.
And I want to talk about that a little more in a minute. But I'm curious, if regret is not a fair word to ask you to attach or deny, I'm just wondering what word is a fair word?
Well, regret, as I say in the book, you would be inhuman if you didn't feel devastated by the loss of life and by the people that have died, our soldiers, your soldiers, the civilians. But you can't say I regret a decision if you actually think it was the right decision. You know, in a sense, when people want you to sum up in a word, what they want you to do is sum up in a headline something that, in my judgment, isn't really susceptible, either emotionally or politically, of being summed up in a word or a headline.
Would you describe for people a letter from an Iraqi woman that you say you have kept in your desk all these years?
Yes, this was someone who came to see me before the Iraq conflict. And I remember sitting in Downing Street, up in the drawing room in Downing Street, and her explaining to me how her family had been tortured and killed by Saddam and how the country was crying out for release from Saddam. And then after May 2003, when Saddam was toppled, she went back to Iraq. And then a few months later, sectarians killed her. And as I say in the book, you know, what would she say to me now? And that's, I think, the question that's why I say it's not very easy to make this judgment right now. What would she say? I don't know.
What do you make of that? Because you could have received thousands of letters like that. There are thousands of stories like that.
There are thousands of stories like that. And the question is, as one Iraqi put it to me, but why do we have to have a choice between rule by Saddam or rule by terror? Why can't we have what you have? They actually would prefer governments that they elect and a rule of law they can rely on. And why shouldn't they? But one of the things I say in the book, and I really believe very passionately, is the West got to, after everything that's happened, the financial crisis, the security issues we face, we should still have confidence in our own way of life. It is actually the way of life that most people in the world aspire to if they had the chance.
You also write about the battle of different narratives when it comes to the battle against terrorism. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is we've got to get ourselves out of the position in the West of believing we are causing this terrorism. Or when these people drive car bombs into whether it's Baghdad or Kabul, that somehow this is something we have caused.
That's a narrative you're talking about and that you write about that a lot of people in the Islamic world will accept, that the West has oppressed Muslims, has backed up corrupt governments, mm-hmm. and that leads to terrorism and may even justify terrorism. That's the narrative you're talking about.
Yeah, and that narrative unfortunately stretches even into parts of our own way of thinking.
What's wrong with it?
It's just wrong.
Are parts of it true?
No, I don't think, frankly, any part of it's true. I can tell you back in the UK, Muslims have the right of freedom of worship to a degree that in many Muslim countries they can't exercise. You know, people are free in our countries.
A little bit earlier this year, a former head of MI5, British Intelligence Service, gave testimony about the war in Iraq, in which she said that war, or perhaps we should say the narrative of that war, radicalized many Muslims inside Britain and outside Britain to turn against the West. Did the decision to go to war in Iraq, the inevitable decision to have Westerners killing Muslims with the inevitable propaganda that would be made of that, turn out to be counterproductive?
First of all, let's just be clear. The majority of people that have died in Iraq have died actually Muslim-on-Muslim violence, right? In reality, the issue is this. There are two competing strains of thought within Islam. One is modernizing, sensible, that says, look, in the end, Islam's problems are for Islam to sort out, and we will sort them out, and we're going to embrace the 21st century. The other is a narrative that is about a victimization by the West and leaders that are complicit with the West, that is a narrative that leads, in the end, to conflict.
What would you do to get your narrative a little more strength?
Well, let's have the sort of good news rather than the bad news, as it were. I think this extremism that we're facing, it's more like, to me, it's more like something like revolutionary communism. In other words, you know, it's a global ideological movement, but it will take a generation to confront and to knock out. But in the end, the only way of defeating it is with a better idea. And that better idea is one that many people are articulating, actually, in the Arab countries that I see now. There's big process of modernization, even a country like Saudi Arabia. I mean, its king is taking, you know, really brave decisions, pushing the country forward. And so there are these modernizing forces there, and we've got to be there with them.
You mentioned the analogy with the Cold War, with fighting communism, which was a political system, but basically an economic argument. This is a better, fairer economic system. And it was very easy for the West to counter that simply by pointing out, we're richer than you are. Everybody is healthier than you are. We have more stuff. We have blue jeans. We have things that you would like. Is it harder to make, in effect, a religious or moral argument because this is a religious movement you're fighting?
No, it's not harder, but it's worth remembering. Back in the 1950s, if you recall, it wasn't so obvious that the economics all went the West's way. It became obvious later. There were many people in your country and in my country who basically thought, look, we don't like the repression of the Soviet system, but nonetheless, economically, they can deliver greater benefits to people. So it took quite a time, actually, for the economic argument to come through. Today, this is why it's so important to counter at a religious, I know it sounds an odd thing to say, but at a religious level, as well as at a political level, an ideology that says, I have the true path to salvation. Anyone who doesn't agree with me is basically an infidel. And we are engaged in what is, in some senses, a similar notion of saying, no, there is actually a different way of looking at the world, which is to say, I'm a Christian, you're a Muslim or a Jew, but we don't have to triumph over you and you don't have to triumph over us in the religious sphere. We can coexist together.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is the author of a memoir, A Journey, My Political Life. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Find a link to excerpts of Blair's book on Twitter. Go to NPR Inskeep. It's NPR News. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has given much thought to public opinion in the Muslim world. He met with U.S. officials this week in Washington as Mideast peace talks neared. He's also talking about a new memoir, and elsewhere today we hear Blair's views about the West and the Muslim world. His memoir also reviews his political career in which he won 3 national elections before losing popularity. He remembers the day he had to speak about the death of Princess Diana. You write something that reflects on her character and also on your own. You write, we were both in our ways manipulative people, perceiving quickly the emotions of others and able instinctively to play with them. What makes you think of yourself that way?
I think if you're a politician, you have to have an intuitive grasp of people. And politics is a business of constant persuasion. Now, I don't mean manipulative, I hope, in an unpleasant sense, but I think you need to be able to know how you can shape public opinion as well as simply follow it.
Now, when you write this memoir, you're not just talking about shaping public opinion, but also dealing face-to-face with other politicians or leaders of other countries, and you write actually in considerable detail about noticing someone's facial expression, a change in the timbre of someone's voice, or what they don't say.
Yeah. Now, these are really important things. I mean, I think one of the things people don't understand properly about politics is it depends enormously on being able to get into a situation of comfort and good faith with somebody. And, I mean, I always say this to any, you know, younger person who wants to take up a political career. Yes, it's about ideas, it's about programs, it's about manifestos, but above all else, it's about people. It's about what makes them tick, what makes them as they are. And if you don't understand that or don't enjoy actually trying to understand it, then don't go into politics.
That's former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, whose new memoir is called A Journey. Elsewhere in today's program, we ask why he still supports the war in Iraq. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News. Many Tea Party activists are drawing inspiration from an unlikely creature. They're telling each other to be more like a starfish and less like a spider. The strengths and weaknesses of those creatures are compared in a business book. Rod Beckstrom is co-author of The Starfish and the Spider, The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations. How did you first find out that people in the Tea Party movement were recommending your book?
Yeah, you know, we started to see it on Twitter, started to see blog pieces online, and people mentioned it to me. I think it was about a year ago. I mean, early on when the movement started getting going, I think some of the members were first reading the book.
You weren't a Tea Party activist yourself?
No, I was not.
So what did you think when you first heard this?
It made sense. I mean, the book is really a guidebook for people to help organize decentralized movements and organizations of any type.
When you say the starfish and the spider, which is what you say in the title, what do you mean?
Well, what we mean is if we look at these two creatures, superficially they look very similar. They have a lot of arms or legs. But if we dissect them, we see that they're perfectly dissimilar. And in looking at their internal physiology, we get a new model for understanding organizations. If we cut off the leg of an adult spider, we just get a crippled 7-legged spider. But if we cut off the head of the spider, it dies because it's a centralized organism. Now, that's how we've looked at organizations in the West for the last several hundred years, top-down, spider-like. There's a CEO or there's someone in control. Mm-hmm. But the world is seeing a profusion of new organizations that are a lot more like a starfish. A starfish has between 4 and 50 arms. If you cut off one arm of a starfish, it can regenerate. In some species of starfish, like the blue Lynkea, if you cut off all 5 arms, you get 5 new starfish. That's possible because the starfish is a completely decentralized organism.
Decentralized meaning there's not a brain in there someplace?
It has intelligence, but the intelligence is distributed through each of the arms. When those communicate with each other, they're even more intelligent as a group, but each arm has its own intelligence in it.
So who are some human organizations that you would compare to the starfish?
In the book, we talk about the Apache Indians, a tribe that was incredibly decentralized. And because of how decentralized they were able to withstand the centralized Spanish opponents for literally hundreds of years. So the Apaches, or we talk about the Craigslist community online being highly decentralized and driven by each community individually.
So in what way, if at all, does the Tea Party movement fit this model?
The Tea Party movement fits the model because there's no one in charge, no individual. If you take one unit out, the whole still continues. It is a movement. It has cohesion. The cohesion is around the very term Tea Party, and the cohesion is held through the values, and it is values that hold large decentralized networks together. And in this case, it's the anti-tax values. It's the anti-big government, a set of core values that are held by the different groups.
I wonder if I can just test that notion for a moment. That does sound very exciting if you're a member of a movement like that, and it must be very exciting for members of the Tea Party movement to hold up your book and say, this is what we are. But are you convinced, looking from the outside, that this is entirely a genuine movement and not one that's been generated the way that opposition movements have been sort of generated in the past by people with the money and the connections to do it?
I think there's way too much energy behind this on a sociological sense. I think the impetus was clearly concerns about the economic meltdown and very aggressive national programs creating concerns in some people. So are there some parties that may have come in and funded it and helped it to shape it or steer it? Absolutely. Is that what gave rise to it? No.
Is it hard to sustain a movement like this? And if so, why?
You know, one of the things that happens, because there's no centralized control and precise definition of what it is or what it's not, there can be a lot of fighting and tearing over time at what does it represent. An example would be I went on the web to research, what are the Tea Party principles? Well, there are no centralized principles. And then there's different chapters and groups and movements that have published their view. As that happens, you're going to see people and parties trying to come in and steer that power or energy into an institution of their liking. That itself creates a process of friction that could lead to diminishment of camaraderie and shared spirit.
And the more specific that a movement gets about what it wants and who it wants to support, the more likely it is that some people aren't going to agree with the direction the movement's going.
Absolutely. You know, when it starts off with these high-level goals that really almost everyone can agree with, and then it starts, narrowing down things such as, more fiscal responsibility, personal responsibility, rule of law. But the more you get down into the details, then you start getting into fighting lines or debate lines. It's going to be very interesting to watch this, to see how it develops. And I don't think this movement's going away for a while. It'll be with us for quite some number of years.
That's Rod Beckstrom, co-author of The Starfish and the Spider. His theory of the starfish gets some people thinking about business, others thinking of sociology, and still others, as we've heard, about politics. It gets us thinking about actual starfish, so we went to visit some. You can find them at the Invertebrate House of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C.
Up there in the upper right corner, we have what are called purple sea stars, which is kind of odd because they're not actually purple. They're different, more of a beige color.
That's zookeeper Michael Miller.
Starfish have some pretty remarkable things about them.
For one thing, they don't have muscles. Instead, they use a hydraulic system to move around. So let's check that basic statement made by author Rod Beckstrom.
If you cut off one arm of a starfish, it can regenerate.
Zookeeper Michael Miller says that is true, mostly. Most starfish require a part of the central body to remain attached to that arm in order to regenerate. Turns out there are some sea creatures, though, that are even better at survival.
An animal that has, really, really impressive regenerative techniques is a sponge, really. You can take a sponge and literally shove it through a sieve. It individually separates each and every cell, and each of those will cluster back together and form new little sponges all together.
Okay. So now let's examine that other creature that Rod Bextrom mentioned, the spider.
But if we cut off the head of the spider, it dies.
Turns out that spiders don't technically have heads.
It has two major body segments. It has an abdomen and what we call a cephalothorax, which is kind of a fusion of the head and the thorax region. So they don't have a distinct separate head, per se.
That may point to some of the only real flaws in Rod Bextrom's theory of the spider and the starfish. Bextrom wants you to consider whether your organization should be more like one or the other. As it turns out, though, neither creature has a backbone or much of a brain.
George Clooney stars in a new movie opening today called The American. He plays Jack, an elusive gunmaker hiding out in Italy from mysterious assassins. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The paranoid thriller The American is spare, solemn, uninflected. It's like Camus' The Stranger and all the pulp novels in the 50s and 60s, French and American, that cribbed its existential worldview. The movie has an amoral hero with no ties who moves from country to country, sheds past lives, and either kills for money or crafts weapons for other assassins. The film is so studiously desolate that I think if at the screening I attended someone had giggled in the wrong place, it would have opened the floodgates. It would have been like Mystery Science Theater with the audience heckling George Clooney and his God's Loneliest Man act. But the silence held, and the movie cast a spell. We entered the mind of a man with no past or future, only a present made tenuous by a bullet that could come at any time. One reason for the movie's power is a shocking opening sequence, an assassination attempt on a frozen lake in Sweden. I won't spell out what happens, but it lingers in the mind for the next hour and a half. Then Jack flees to Italy, where he contacts a man named Pavel, who seems to be his employer. I say seems because the movie does little by design to orient you. Johan Lassen's Pavel has a ravaged face and a chill demeanor. He only seems curious about the woman with Jack on that Swedish lake.
Who was the girl?
A friend.
A friend?
Who are the Swedes?
I'm working on that. It's going to take some time. Did she set you up?
She had nothing to do with it.
Pity. You can't stay here. I've made arrangements for you to leave town while I sort this out. Take right outside the bar, then second left, Via Magenta. You'll find a dark blue Fiat Tempra with Pescara plates. I've marked a small town on the map, Castelvecchio. Stay there, lay low till you get my call. Don't talk to anyone. And above all, don't make any friends, Jack. You used to know that.
The American is full of passages like that, with pauses, hidden agendas, minutiae. There are long scenes in which Jack does nothing but construct a weapon to a female client's specification for purposes unknown, a machine gun with the range of a rifle, and a device to disguise the shooter's location. For a while, the only interludes of talk are Jack's exchanges with the old priest of an Abruzzo hill town. The father, played by Paolo Bonicelli, utters thesis lines like, "You're American. You think you can escape history. You live for the present." And, "You cannot doubt the existence of hell. You live in it. It's a place without love." That was where Clooney lived in his last movie, too, Up in the Air, and I get a sense he's trying to deepen his persona. That might be a doomed enterprise. Clooney is naturally gregarious, a disarmingly handsome smoothie with a toasty, caressing voice. He pulled off the brooding thing in Michael Clayton, but he doesn't here. Yes, he's magnetic, and he's lost a lot of weight for the film, trimming himself down to muscle and sinew. But when he stares blankly off screen, he's just blank. He's rather different from the loquacious and British hero of the novel on which The American is based, Martin Booth's A Very Private Gentleman, who aims to be, quote, as indistinguishable from the next man as a pebble on the beach. Clooney's the last guy I'd cast as an anonymous assassin. The Netherlands-born director, Anton Corbin, helps by making the landscape do the talking. There are lots of paranoia-inducing overhead shots. Empty spaces alternate with twisty ancient stone stairs and shadowed passageways. As in Up in the Air, Jack does make a new friend, Clara, a prostitute played by the oxymoronically named Violante Placido. I wondered why she was so familiar with her soft, open face and voluptuous body. It turns out she's the daughter of Simonetta Stefanelli, unforgettable as Michael Corleone's doomed Sicilian bride in The Godfather. On every substantive level, The American is ridiculous. The book has a conventional whodunit solution, but the film, like Antonioni's The Passenger, leaves you with a giant why? But I enjoyed it anyway. It takes you back to an era of European angst-ridden art thrillers in which the plotting was almost abstract. The American is, well, the least American action movie in years.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.